Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and today we have not one, but two pod debuts. The first from This Is Money's new deputy editor. You might know him, a Mr. Lee Boyce. Congrats on the promotion, by the way, Lee. And alongside Ali is news editor Mike Sheen. Mike, welcome. Coming up, inflation hits its highest level in a decade this week, but that's not even expected to be the peak. So why is the cost of living on the rise? When will interest rates go up? And whether you're a saver, investor, mortgage holder, prospective property buyer, or business owner, how exactly is it going to impact you? Also today, is the state pension triple lock doomed? A special delivery for Royal Mail shareholders, the banks that say serve yourself, and is TSB's new savings prize draw better than premium bonds? Don't be getting stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, inflation rose from 3.1% to 4.2% in the year to October. That's its highest level in 10 years, piling pressure on households, businesses and the Bank of England. Rising energy costs, surges in fuel prices, upcoming tax rises and a potential increase in interest rates mean, will we all face being a little bit worse off? The Institute of Fiscal Studies reckons those on 30,000 will have about £1,420 less to live on. But what is happening? Why is it going up? When will rates rise? What does it all mean? Mike, welcome. I'll come to you first.
Oh, thank you. As you say, inflation is certainly proving to be slightly less transitory than the Bank of England, or indeed any other central bank, was initially expecting. There were a few premature signs of relief last month when the rate came in below expectations, but this was just a reflection of comparisons to the eat out to help out era last year. So this month's figure pointed to soaring housing costs as a key contributor, and that's certainly reflected in housing prices at the moment. But the underlying issue really here is the energy market, and in the context of the UK, the price cap hike, in addition to the ongoing supply chain issues we're seeing globally. You know, we're coming out of lockdowns worldwide, demand has soared, and there's difficulty meeting that demand. So this is really feeding through to the rest of the economy. Virtually every company is talking about a challenging outlook in terms of inflation and supply chain issues. They're hiking prices in response, and we're feeling that.
Like you said, people thought it was transitory, and now it's not looking quite so transitory. How do we get that wrong? Why do they think it would just poof, disappear soon?
Yeah, no, that's right. I think probably growth has been a little bit more tricky than people were expecting. And, you know, we've had obviously a lot of changes in the energy market, but, you know, that this has got a lot further to go. We're not at the end of this yet.
We expected the Bank of England, or some people did, I think quite a few people did, to raise rates last month. They didn't. Perhaps in the next meeting in December. But is there really anything that raising rates can do about this situation?
Yeah, no, that's right. We're expecting, once again, a very, very minor rise from the current rate of 0.1% to 0.25. And, you know, as we've just discussed, this is a structural issue. This is a global issue that we're facing. And a tiny, tiny increase is unlikely suddenly to make the energy crisis go away and energy costs to go down. So this is going to do probably very little to impact overall inflation. But it's about normalising policy.
Yeah, do you reckon it's coming then? And when?
Well, we're certainly expecting this month, but as you said, we expected last month. Financial markets expect that. I was speaking to a bond fund manager last week, actually, who likened the Bank of England's current action to the Maradona goal from the 86 World Cup versus England. You know, he runs in a straight line, but he ends up, you know, sending about seven England players flying just by dipping his shoulders. So what the Bank of England is doing is giving the impression of action. Well, it's actually just staying the course it wants. But again, we are expecting them to move this month.
Thank you very much, Mike. Mike, Lee, I've got Mike already playing the game of when will interest rates rise. It's only his first 5 minutes. More about how it's going to hit the pound in our pocket, as it were, Lee. We've got some predictions that we stand to be a couple of grand out of pocket when you encompass everything that's going on, tax rises, you know, potential interest rate rises, cost of goods going up, etc.
I think 2022 is going to be a really tricky year, Georgie, for people's personal finances. There's a lot of factors at play at the moment. And, you know, this inflation figure, you know, they're talking about it being 5%, you know, through to spring. We've seen it really bite already, and we're saying 4.2%, but for many people it would probably feel like a much bigger inflation rise with that. I mean, we're thinking about the price cap of the energy market. That's what's really bitten here. But there's things like used car prices. They're continuing 80th week in a row that used car prices have gone up. That's been mentioned in the inflation report. We've got things like hotels and restaurants becoming more expensive. Petrol prices are at record highs. I think we might have reached the peak of petrol prices, hopefully, but it's not saying that that's a definite. But those kind of things are already hitting people's pockets. Now, next year, there's some other things coming into play that are going to really bite. Number one is the National Insurance 1.25 pence rise in the pound. That's gonna really bite people. But you know, in terms of inflation as well, you know, there's things like mobile phone bills, broadband, the telecoms things that we sort of have every year, and we know there's going to be rises. Most of these telecoms firms will rise it by 3.9% plus the January inflation figure. That could mean an 8-9% rise in bills for broadband for your wow. TV package, for your all of those kind of things. Council tax is probably going to be up on average about 3% from April. That national insurance bite that I spoke about is going to suck money out of people's wages. It's a worrying
time.
Is it
a cost of living crisis, Lee?
I think you could argue, you could really argue that it is. And it affects people in different ways. You know, it depends what you buy. It depends how you live your life. And it depends, you know, where you are in terms of work. Because let's not forget, we've had wage growth. You know, we've had high wage growth, but that's not for everyone. You know, it doesn't, whereas something like this inflation figure, not everyone, but a large chunk, I think something like 15 million households have now got pricier energy bills as a result of the energy crisis. If you were lucky enough to have fixed and been with a firm that hasn't gone bust, then you've managed to ride it out. But there's talks of the price cap next April being potentially £400 more expensive. Now, that is a lot of money on top of already the huge hike we saw in October. And then, you know, there's things like the triple lock pension, right? So pensioners are going to see 3.1% rise in state pension. Well, now that looks really not very generous at all, you know, after removing that wage growth element of the triple lock to essentially now make it a double lock. Pensioners tend to feel the squeeze even more so because they tend to have the heating on more, tend to be inside more. That doesn't look so generous now, does it? I mean, when you're looking at 4.2% inflation potentially rising to 5%, I think next year there's worrying signs for especially low-income households. And you know, it's not just low-income households. I feel like the, you know, middle earners are going to be really squeezed by this as well. Now, you pointed to that IFS study about if you earn 30 grand, you're going to be £1,420 worse off in real terms next year. I mean, that's
a big chunk of your
money. That's a big chunk.
Yeah.
You know, but it is a global problem, inflation. But there was an interesting little bit, of information here from a Daily Mail story. This is when you know this is big. You know, this is front page of the Daily Mail, big, you know, in the week, the inflation thing. Because the general public, I think sometimes things like this kind of pass them by a little bit. Inflation sounds boring. What's that all about? You know, yes, things feel a bit more expensive, but how does it really affect me? But it does affect you in a lot of ways. You know, food prices are up, clothing prices are up, energy prices, petrol prices, everything's kind of going up. There's this little bit of information here that as things stand, a typical family of four will be forced to spend an extra £1,800 this year on energy bills, transport, grocery, clothes and leisure compared with 2020. That's this year. This is 2021. Wow. And then go on to next year and it could be even more than that. I think that is a worry. It is a big worry. And Rishi Sunak, remember we did the podcast a little while back on the budget, and he did point to inflation, the global inflation problem, in that. And actually, we've seen it in the States; it's riding even higher. It's a worry. It is a worry for household finances.
Any positive news for us, Mike? Anything on the horizon? I mean, how long is this going to last for?
This is, you know, we're going to go to above 5% by the end of the year, very likely, probably into early January. And, you know, Hugh Pill, who's just joined the Bank of England very recently, he's saying that he doesn't expect it to start to normalise until the second half of next year. So this is going to be with us for a while.
Do you know what's annoying about it? It's a basket of goods. right? It's a general basket of goods. It's not my basket. It's the Bank of England's basket of goods. And yet a lot of companies, as Lee just pointed out there, you know, mobile phones, your broadband, your TV, your rail, all these sorts of things, your rent often goes up by the CPI inflation measure, some RPI, but it depends. And it's not like they're going to go back to that. So for this period that is, you know, transitory or not, or 1 year or 6 months or however long this is going to last for, it's not like they're going to go, oh, you know, that 10% rise in your mobile phone bill. Well, it was really high last year, so we're actually going to bring it down again. It's not. That's it. And then from the next year, it's just going to keep going up. So no matter how long this is going to last for, the effects are going to be a lot longer than that. I didn't really have a point to that. I just thought I would just rant about it. Let's focus on the positives because I've now just had my rant. Lee, what can you do? Let's focus on your savings nest egg and I'll get Mike to talk about investments.
Sure thing. So look, I mean, it is impossible to beat inflation with a savings account. And actually, when inflation was last at 4.2%, Georgie, it was December 2011. This podcast didn't even exist. Can you believe that? And you could get a one-year bond paying 3.6%. And at the time, base rate was 0.5%. So you could get 3.6% on a year fixed rate. Didn't quite match inflation, but it wasn't far off. Today, the top one-year bond is 1.35%, and the top easy access rate is something like 0.67%. I mean, in real terms, your money in savings can't keep up, but a lot of people like to have their money held in savings, especially pensioners who want to rely on a kind of low-risk, you know, way of holding their money. Unfortunately, it's just nigh impossible, and even with a base rate rise potentially before the end of the year, I'll be honest, I think it's going to happen. Andrew Bailey was waiting for jobs data, I believe. That was the big pointer in the last sort of reason why they didn't vote to raise rates. And I think that now we've seen the jobs data, I think it's all systems go. But it is very unlikely that big banks are going to end up raising rates from a lot of people are getting paid 0.01%, Georgie. I think something like 25% of savings is in accounts paying 0.01% with big banks. Big banks aren't going to all of a sudden get generous and go, oh, you know, there's been a base rate rise, so let's put savings rates up. You know, you've got to be out there and actively looking for the best rates. We actually had news from NS&I as well, income bonds, which are, you know, one of the most popular products, but crashed to 0.01%. They've gone up 15-fold to 0.15%. Wow, excellent. Why? Yeah, let's get that income in. Well, NS&I is actually struggling to meet its financing targets for the year because where they've cut things back to the bone, they've cut rates and products back to the bone, they're actually now going to have to start raising some rates to get people to get money pouring back in after last year in the start of the pandemic, the first few months basically offering the best rate of interest and everyone piling into it. It's now struggling to get money to pour in and keeping that checks and balances in. So savings wise, inflation proofing your finances is very, very difficult. You know, you're going to go and talk to Mike about investing, and investing really it's the option really that's going to potentially get you 5% plus growth, but it's for the long term. As we always say, it's got to be for at least 5-10 years. Having a savings account, if you're someone who doesn't have a huge pot of cash or whatnot, it's important to have, we always say this, it is important to try and build a little buffer in there, especially with things that are prices going up potentially even more. But I know it's difficult for people, so it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. One of the biggest things I would be doing to inflation-proof your finances potentially is asking for a pay increase in your job. You know, if you're someone that hasn't had a pay increase...
Like you, Lee. Well done, by
the way. No, but you know what I'm trying to say. You know, not all companies are generous enough to give you an annual inflation-linked pay rise. Sometimes you've got to, if you don't ask, you don't get. Mm-hmm. And the job market actually is holding up pretty well at the moment. It's quite vibrant. There's jobs out there. So, you know, it might be worth, depending on your position, you know, in your job, of seeing if there's something else out there paying more, or if you're happy where you are, you know, no harm, no foul.
Indeed, indeed. Mike, investment expert.
Yeah, more positive. As you said, certainly not cash, certainly not bonds. They're not going to give you the inflation beating returns you need. So traditionally, gold is seen as the go-to asset class when it comes to inflation. It's seen as this anchor of value, I suppose. And you might want to invest in gold directly, or you can invest in a precious metals ETF, for example. Some people are now arguing that Bitcoin acts as an inflationary hedge, though I'm not sure there's quite the evidence of that yet. So it pretty much leaves you with equities as the only game in town for inflation-beating returns. And a really good way in the UK to get that is through equity income investment trusts. You know, they pay these inflation-beating income as well as total returns. So there's plenty of them to choose from in the UK market. And, you know, many of them are trading at discounts at the moment. So you can grab yourself a bargain on it.
Good advice. Now, our next story is linked to inflation, though technically not anymore. The triple lock. A couple of weeks ago, Artania told us about a rebel House of Lords amendment trying to stop the suspension of the guarantee for a year. Now, it failed. Politicians and financial experts, as a result of warning that elderly people will face hardship and fears, have been raised that the triple lock could be tweaked or even scrapped for good in the future. Lee, what happened in the House of Commons related to the House of Lords?
Well, there was a vote over the triple lock. There was a vote whether or not, you know, the triple lock should remain in the form it was before, deciding to remove the wage growth element for the year. And, you know, we were kind of warning beforehand that this was all well and good, but it was unlikely that it was going to see MPs vote against it happening. So That's exactly what's happened. So it's sticking at 3.1%. Do you remember, Georgie, I said the fair thing to do was a 5% rise. I said that it should meet in the middle between the 3.1 and the 8.whatever% figure it was. I stick by that. And now it seems like it makes perfect sense. It just about beats inflation, and it would have been a kind of kind thing to do.
Politically speaking, it's a better thing, because you're not actually, and this is where this story lies, is look, if you can change this for just 1 year, well, you can change it. This was a manifesto promise that they would keep this in place. That has been broken now. So if you can break a promise once, you can break it then in the future. They may as well just disband it. Whereas if they'd taken your approach, Lee, had they listened, I think it would have been, look, we're not suspending it. We're not changing. We just have to, for this year, because it's such an outlier, we're doing something completely different. And I think that would have been politically easier to swallow. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
And I think now it seems, as I said a minute ago, it just seems extra harsh when we're seeing inflation at 4.2%, seeing inflation potentially 5% at the start of next year, potentially not dipping back anywhere near towards the Bank of England target until the second half of next year. It's going to be quite a hot political topic, I'm going to guess, that's going to stretch on for quite some time. You know, the government will argument, well, it was a strange time, you know, with the pandemic, and that's why wage growth figures were skewed. It's such a hard thing to kind of now go back on, as you say, you know, changing it. And it was a key manifesto pledge. And there are a lot of angry people that rely on state pension are not happy about this news whatsoever. And this could come back to bite at the next general election, which I know is a way off. But, you know, people remember these things, Georgie. You know, they remember these things. And it has seemed almost Grinch-like now. Yeah. When we come up to Christmas, I can't put in too many Christmas content before December, but it doesn't bode well, and our readers are incredibly upset about this. I think we were talking about this poll we had. We have the ability to put polls on the website, and you know, we never look at anything basically under 2,000 respondents really for an accurate kind of response. And I know it's kind of skewed because it's our readership and whatnot, but 22,000 people voted on that, and 93% of people believe that the triple lock should have stayed as it was.
That does, I have to say, that does surprise me. I know you said it's because your readership is financially engaged, probably a little bit older. I don't know, you'll know the demographics of this, but 93% of 22,000, that's not a small poll either.
No.
That's huge.
And that's why I mentioned it, to be honest with you. I wouldn't tend to mention polls that run on the website, but that one feels quite significant. And yeah, all you have to do is dip into some of the comments that are on the stories and the coverage that we've had this week. We had Ros Altman give us 10 reasons why the government was wrong on this subject. And the comments in there are, you know, our readers, when they've got a bee in their bonnet, and they articulate things really well in that reader comment section, you do get a real kind of feel for what's going on. You know, this doesn't affect me today because I'm in my 30s, right? That doesn't affect, but it does affect me in the future, because if it had gone up by 8-odd% that's only going to benefit me in later years. And I think that's what kind of, I don't want to pitch this between young versus old. You know, older people want the state pension rise. Of course they do. Younger people think, oh, that's way too generous and they shouldn't have that. It's not about that. It's about a fair rise. It's about a manifesto pledge. It's about a cost of living crisis that, you know, is really starting to unfold. And it's making sure that pensioners and everyone in society is treated fairly.
To put the devil's advocate, though, and probably the reason why they did this, this is a generational fairness thing, though, isn't it? I mean, it's young people who are going to be hit incredibly hard already by the national insurance. We're talking about student loan repayments. All of these issues are really going to hit young people. And it's like, yes, they will benefit in the future to the detriment of now. Mike?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you've got to remember a large proportion of what you might consider the younger generation, so to speak. You know, they came of age at the time of the global financial crisis, and now they're kind of in their 20s or early 30s now, as coming out of COVID. And, you know, it's a generation of people who have had their finances placed as a secondary priority to every other section of society, in effect. So, yeah, no, it's tough.
Yeah, those in their 30s have been hammered twice by two, you know, once in a generation, we said events. Lee, is that it, though, for the triple lock, do you think? Is this the slippery slope? Because, I mean, it feels like it's been here forever, but it hasn't. When did it come in? 2010?
Yeah, it was the start of the Cameron government, yeah. And to be honest, is it gone for good now? I mean, as you say, you change it once, and what stops you from having to stick with it in the future? I guess it all depends next year if wage growth or inflation is running too high for the government to decide that, no, that's too much, that's too generous a hike. But that's the danger of having a system like this. It's all well and good when it's all sort of ticking away nicely and there's never a sort of above 5% increase. But when something like this happens, all of a sudden, a manifesto pledge, something that has been almost like in concrete, you know, something that has been a vote winner, something that has been a popular move, is in danger. It's hard to say. Who knows, Georgie? Honestly, sometimes it's like, I don't know what's going to happen sort of tomorrow.
Oh, give it a guess, Lee. Let's play a new game.
Give it a guess.
Give it a year. How long do you reckon? 2 years? 5, 10?
I can't guess, Georgie. No, don't make me guess. It's impossible.
We'll probably won't be around anyway.
I feel like I've got to sit firmly on the fence in this one. I hope they don't scrap it. I hope they don't, because, you know, it doesn't look good, does it? And, you know, there's other little things that are happening. I say little things, pretty big things are happening. Things like income tax thresholds being frozen and that kind of thing as well. You know, who knows? I can't make a prediction.
I'm going to go 6 years. Mike, what do you reckon? When's the next election? Who's going to benefit most, politically speaking?
Who's going to benefit most? Yeah, I mean, Labour certainly need to win more of the older vote, and the Tories are going to be scrambling to hold on to it now, I think. But
in that case, we're never going to get rid of it, are we?
Well, you know, I think my only prediction in terms of state pensions really is that I'm fairly confident there won't be a state pension by the time I retire.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there is that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll pay for it anyway. So
fair dues. Do your bit, Mike. In business, as in life, there are winners and there are losers. And then there's a global pandemic that comes along and throws everything up in the air. Royal Mail has announced that it's set to hand out £400 million to shareholders following a rather bumper period for the company, as online deliveries have soared. Pre-tax profits swelled from 17 million to 315 million compared with the same period a year ago. Mike, delve into these figures a little bit more. Royal Mail, where were they? Where are they now?
That's right. Well, yeah, so Royal Mail has been a big beneficiary of the pandemic. Domestic deliveries in the UK in particular, they're up more than 30% on pre-COVID levels. And that's allowed it to generate £6.1 billion in just 6 months in terms of revenues. It now also expects to be entirely debt-free within 2 years. So, you know, what have they decided to do? Well, they're going to reward shareholders with a huge payout, £200 million in share buybacks and £200 million in a special dividend. Obviously, this was welcomed by a lot of investors who, to be fair, have had to put up with quite a lot in the last few years. But, you know, Royal Mail share prices really struggled for a couple of years.
Where were they? Like, to me, I thought, that's it. No one's ever sending birthday cards again and Royal Mail are out.
Well, this is it. I mean, we're talking about a company that still might be booted from the FTSE 100 at the next reshuffle. You know, and, you know, actually, some investors really did question the wisdom of this move. They're saying, you know, hang on, why aren't you reinvesting all this spare cash you've suddenly got? You know, we've got these supply chain issues, which we've discussed already, and Christmas is a month away. Why aren't you holding on to this cash and toughening up your defences, so to speak?
So it looks a great story, but that's what I say. Underneath it, what are investors really thinking about Royal Mail, Royal Mail's prospects? I mean, in terms of its, one, the external issues, are we expected to do online delivery? I imagine this is now changed for pretty much good. So the external factors are there looking positive, but what about inside?
Well, this is it. I think what's really important to remember when it comes to Royal Mail is that there is, you know, talking about reinvestment, but they are on a major modernization drive at the moment to try and kind of get up to date and make their processes that much smoother. But also another tailwind potentially is, you know, their international business still hasn't recovered because of all the friction on the borders in terms of COVID, etc. So they're making record profits and revenues at the moment with effectively one arm tied behind their back. So potentially a very good outlook. But, you know, we'll just wait and see.
All right, then, we will indeed. Now, for years, This Is Money have been very keen, shall we say, and quite pushy to try and keep bank branches open so that their readers, so that customers can manage their money in person. Indeed, for many things, you still actually have to go into branch. Yet they're experiencing an alarming rate, forcing people to travel for miles for a face-to-face service. Yet even when branches are open, some banks are increasingly bullying, is the word used, customers into using self-service machines instead. Now, banking giant Barclays has been accused of quietly introducing new rules to restrict what transactions can be carried out at the counter. Lee Boyce, bullying. I know you didn't write this article. Strong word. What's going on here?
That is quite a strong word, I must admit. Look, I'm a bit softer on this, George. Before I wade into this, in the last 10 years, the number of banking competitors that have come in, these new wave challengers who are way more nimble than the big banks. I'm thinking Monzo's, the Starlings. You know, they've come in, it's app only. They don't have branches. They don't have legacy systems. They've been able to build things from scratch. And in that, the result of that is that they've managed to attract customers with a sleek, good-looking app, especially younger people, but not just exclusively younger people. There's plenty of older people that are comfortable enough banking and doing everything on an app or online, right? Banks had a big branch network, and we've seen this over the years, the last branch in town shutting, all of that kind of thing. And actually, there's been 2,766 branches shut in 5 years. You know, banks are there to make a profit, right? Let's put that straight out there. You know, they're there to make profits, right? And if they've got branches that are not being used that much, it's almost like having this big, white, expensive elephant that is just there, right? And they're looking to trim costs of all these branches and shrink the network. And, you know, even the branches that are out there, I know we've discussed this before, I feel like a lot of them changed their hours in the pandemic. A lot of them now shut early, and that still hasn't recovered. I've seen some banking queues. I live in a town called Rayleigh in Essex. There's a Barclays, there's an HSBC. There's always a queue. I always see queues there. I think a bit of it is business banking. I think a lot of businesses still use bank counters and bank branches. But it's also a lot of older people that perhaps don't have the internet. They don't feel comfortable transacting money online, using online services. And I can totally understand that. If you're not someone that's that digitally savvy, you know, the last thing you want to do is have that worry about your money, you know, and moving it around online, especially in an age in which Britain seems to be like the number one target for bank fraud, you know. So in that regard, that's the kind of landscape. That's the kind of big picture stuff. Now, what's happening in banks like Barclays and HSBC is that they are keeping some branches open, but the ones they're keeping open, they've been sort of slowly removing counters and humans from the branch, you know, people that you can go and interact with, and, you know, from experience are usually very helpful, you know. And as an older person, I reckon there's quite a lot of older people that rely on bank tellers to help them. That's how it's been, you know. They've probably banked with the same bank for 30, 40, 50 years, and it's what they're used to. It's very hard now to push someone into a branch, get them to use all machines and devices that they're not that comfortable with. And it's, especially if you're not demoing how to use this stuff properly and just relying on things like leaflets and things, it's not good enough. It's not good enough. And I think that there needs to be more support of these kind of withdrawals. It kind of feels like these bank branches get withdrawn and all of a sudden older people especially are left floundering. And it's
a bank's so poor that they can't afford to have a couple of tellers on duty.
But it's
extraordinary. Local shops have that. I don't.
Well, but you say that, Georgie. You know, you go into a supermarket now. How many? The M&S in Kensington. I mean, there's about two people that are on a checkout. No, but it's very often.
I know.
There's two people usually, two or three people on a belt sort of system.
Yeah.
There's about 30 self-service machines, and they're absolutely terrible to use, and I find them a little bit tricky to use. Right. And I'm 34, you know, and I'm not saying that all older people are just like they can't use machines, but it's feeling like that's the way it's all going, essentially. And the reason why I picked this story out, so it has been in the mail the last couple of weeks, but I actually wrote something really similar 7 years ago about Barclays, and it actually, I remember at the time speaking to this lady on the phone for a fair while. And her Barclays branch in Kingston upon Thames was changing in this manner. It was basically overnight, seemingly, machines had replaced staff. And she had no idea what she was doing, you know, paying in money, checks. Yeah. People still rely on checks. You know, I can scan a check on the app and pay it in. A lot of people don't feel comfortable doing that kind of thing. Might not have a smartphone for one. So this is the issue. And I think that the quicker something like these banking hubs become more mainstream, as in there was a pilot in a town really close to me, actually the town I grew up in Rochford, which is just down the road here, in which they pulled four or five different banks, and they were there one day a week. So you had HSBC in there one day,
yeah.
Barclays another day, Lloyds another day, so on and so forth. And there's an actual human in there to go and speak to about your banking. That's a bit of a start. I see that as a kind of a bit of the future. You know, you target, you know, the 200 biggest towns in Britain or whatever and start rolling this out. And there are plans of it, I believe. But for a lot of people, they're just getting the rug pulled out from under their feet pretty quickly. It's a rapidly evolving world in all sorts of ways involving technology. And banking is no different from that, and I feel like the pandemic might have exacerbated it, because yeah. A lot of people have moved to start going online more than they would have done before, and have perhaps felt comfortable with it, which is great, but it's not so great for those that just have no interest.
It's like the banks have this idea, right? We want to get rid of all of the branches, everybody go online. Yes, it's going to save us a ton of money, and tech's going to save the world. That's fine to a degree if the technology is good enough. If people know how to use the technology, and if everything, and I use this because I have a business bank, and if I need to change my address, I have to go in branch. I used to have an HSBC account. If I lost my card or had it stolen, I had to go in branch to pick up the card. This, to me, doesn't make sense. They see where they want to be, but they're so far from that at the moment. Mike, you're nodding along. Rare for me that people nod along to what I'm saying.
I broadly agree just with the sentiment of, there needs to be some sort of access to a human being, because I mean, we talk about money for a living. Most people don't do that. And I think it's important. It comes down to how important you think high street banks are, really. I mean, should we be having a similar argument about, you know, libraries? You know, it's the same situation. They are important.
Yeah, keep the libraries open.
Yeah, exactly.
Haven't been to one in ages, but I like the concept.
And, you know, you potentially leave a generation of people behind. But also, like, I'm in my late 20s and I, you know, certain aspects of money, of monetary issues is I don't want to use a computer for it. Sometimes I do want to speak to a human being about it. And, you know, I can't imagine. I know it's about cost cutting, but I don't seriously believe that Barclays can't afford to have like one guy around. Like,
yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, How expensive is that? Not very. We're just not there yet. Have a bridge to where they want to go. They've just forgotten the bridge. All right, then. Finally, Lee, we've spoken about this, have we not? TSB's new £1,000 monthly draw to help current account customers, get into the habit of saving. But is it any good?
Is it any good? Oh, Georgie, now that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Is it any good? Well, it's not a million-dollar question, because if you want to win £1 million, you invest in the premium bonds and have the most outrageous luck in winning one of its £2 million prizes. What's happened in the last couple of years? It's nothing too new, but it feels like there's been a bigger push towards these. We've seen Halifax, Nationwide, similar sort of schemes. I think what some banks are trying to do, rates are low. Rates are very, very low, especially in high street banks. And they're trying to drum up interest elsewhere by offering things like prize draws. And that's what TSB is doing with this. They're offering a monthly draw. It's a 5 prizes of £1,000 and 50 prizes of £100. So that doesn't sound that great, does it? I mean, I'd love to win a grand, don't get me wrong, but it's not £1 million, you know. But what it does do, you've got to have a savings pot with TSB linked to your current account. It's called Spend and Save or Spend and Save Plus, right? And you just have to have £10 in there. So for that reason, if you're a TSB customer, I would actively say, actually putting £10 into this account, all you've got to do is label the savings pot My Dream, which is quite strange, but you have to label it My Dream. So you know these savings pots, you can call it My Wedding Fund or Buying a Car or all that. You have to label it My Dream. You can stick £10 in there and it's basically essentially you're a part of the draw. And the odds are actually fairly decent because of the numbers of people that are involved. But our readers aren't keen on these things. They label it a gimmick. They say it's a gimmick rather than just have a better rate.
But it is a gimmick. I mean, there's no other way. It's not. It's a gimmick.
Right? It is a gimmick. So apparently TSB is saying,
I mean, it's a bad thing. It is a gimmick.
TSB say 150,000 savings pots are currently opened. And based on the current number of people opted in, there's roughly a 1 in 2,700 chance of winning £1,000 or £100. Or 1 in 445 chance over the course of the 6 month period. This is running for 6 months. It's actually not bad, not bad odds. But Nationwide have got a similar one. You can win £100,000, but there's far more people in that. People just want a rate of interest, Georgie. I think if they want to do something like this, I think they go to premium bonds. Is my take from all of this. But
an informed take it is, Lee.
I think that we're going to see more of these. I don't think they're going away. Yeah, I think we'll see more banks launch these kind of prize draws, these monthly prize draws. But just pay people the interest.
I know, right? but saying that, Mike, as the youngest of us here.
Marginally, I'm sure.
Not in my case. Right. Although sort of surprised by that, Mike, I have to say, you've got a sort of distinguished university professor look about you. You can be 20s and a university professor, distinguished. Anyway, point being, as someone of the younger group, I know that you're an investment expert and I know that you talk about finances, but do you think in terms of your peers that aren't so engaged in finances as you are, that this sort of thing is good? This kind of gamification, and you can throw into that all these apps like Moneybox and stuff, things that kind of incentivize you to save. Is this the answer?
In all honesty, I mean, I don't want to speak for a generation. But,
a bit of stereotyping on here.
Voice of a generation, Mitch.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think £1,000, the vague chance of winning a grand is enough to make people set up a new bank account, to be honest with you. No, I think there's... easier ways to try and get rich quick that don't actually work. So, yeah,
we don't have to go into all of those at the moment. Lee?
Can I just add, I didn't give you the interest, the underlying interest on this pot, did I? It's 0.05% with a 0.04% bonus for the first year. Has that tempted you in?
Right.
You look stunned.
Right, Lee.
Yeah, but again, I'm going to say this. Not it's about angry, getting in the habit, Georgie. If there's something that can get you into the savings habit, first.
No, 100%. This is what I was trying to say with Mike. Look, if this is going to work, then great. I'm not blown away, Lee, I have to say about
that. No, I'd rather just have 0.5% interest. Yeah.
Yeah. Before we leave, I do have to do something. So just bear with me. Bear with me.
Georgie has disappeared from the podcast. I don't know what's going on here. I'm a little bit frightened. Oh, Georgie's rung the doorbell. Oh, I see.
Can you hear that?
Yeah, we heard it.
That is my doorbell. So thankfully for you guys, you weren't here last week when I ranted somewhat about my doorbell. Thank you to everyone who got in contact with me. I've got it. Victory is mine. It may not be legally so, but victory is mine, which just goes to show. I was going to say, don't mess with me, but that's not true. I'm a pushover. Just do the right thing, people. Do the right thing, landlords. You know,
I've got to say, Georgie, it did sound like a right ding dong.
On that note, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
I'm going to do something here quickly, Georgie, as well, actually, before I reveal how you can get in touch with us. I just wanted to give a shout out to Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry, who is leaving us after 16 years at This Is Money. And I'm sure you've heard him on the podcast numerous times in the past. And he's just been a fantastic person to work with all the years that I've been at This Is Money. So I just wanted to give him a quick shout out on the podcast. I did try and get him on today to reflect on his 16 years of This Is Money, but we did have his leaving drinks last night and it probably was a little bit unfair trying to drag him onto the podcast today to reflect on his 16 years at This Is Money.
But can I also add my own thoughts to that too as well? Thank you very much to Aid and to his significant contribution to my book collection. I have a lot more books now about cycling.
Yes, there's one thing about Aid, it's the cycling. Yeah.
He was very disappointed that a lot of my cycling books were about doping and the bad side of cycling. So he was very keen one day to send me an email about all the positive books. And I've got lots of positive books now about cycling. So there we go. Thank you very much, Aid. And for all your contributions, Lee.
Yes, if you want to get in touch with us, Twitter at This Is Money. You can also email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and you can comment on the story in which this podcast is housed.
And Mike, welcome to the This Is Money podcast family. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.